Hello, my friends. I wish you all are doing excellent. This is your friend, Eric Lopez from Houston, Texas, and welcome to the ISOCoach podcast. This podcast is dedicated to you who are responsible for designing, implementing, maintaining, improving, and auditing ISO standards in a way that it adds value to the business. My objective is to give you real experiences that will assist you to be a better and more efficient consultant or internal coach in your organization. The principle is that whatever you do, it must support the business by adding value. This is a professional community for people like you. So, welcome to the ISOCoach podcast. Good morning, my friends all over the world. Auditing is a very important part of any management system. You have internal audits, customer audits, certification audits, and all of those audits have objectives. Well, with social distancing and other travel restrictions, remote auditing became the preferred method to perform audits all over the world. Our listeners in America, Europe, Australia, Africa, and Asia have resolved themselves to perform an audit using this method perfectly accepted by ISO 19011. ISO 19011 is the most important document nowadays that encompasses the consensus of member countries in the International Organization for Standardization, ISO. If we are going to talk about ISO 19011 and specifically about remote auditing, then we should talk about a key person in the development of this document. I'm very honored to have this morning the chair of the ISO PC302, responsible for making the latest version of ISO 19011, Denise Robitaille. Denise just published her latest book precisely about remote auditing. So, Denise, welcome this morning to the ISOCoach podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Eric. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you, Denise. Denise, it is great, and I'm honored to have you here in the ISOCoach. Before starting this interesting conversation with Denise, let me tell you that Denise has been a lead assessor for over 25 years, from internal audits to supplier audits to third-party audits. Her work has spanned a variety of industries and disciplines. She has authored over a dozen books, two of them related to auditing. Over the years, Denise has trained hundreds of auditors. She has participated internationally in standards development for over 18 years. And as I was telling you before, she was the chair for PC302, the project committee that revised ISO 19011. My friends, when I saw Denise managing the ideas and personalities of all kinds of people from all over the world, representing so many interests, I became intrigued by her way in which, you know, that capacity that she had to put all of that together and achieve consensus, which in my experience, writing technical specification and management system standard is no small thing. It is something huge. It's amazing. So I'm very glad to have Denise here. Again, Denise, thank you very much. And you know, I was very interested in your book. When I saw it, I immediately went to Amazon and got it. Please share with us your story in ISO PC 302 and help the audience in the ISOCoach to understand how you made it happen. I mean, how did you end up leading the group? How did you manage to arrive to consensus in such an important document?
Eric, there are several things that go into the success of an international standard. And I was very privileged to be, you know, selected and approved by the Technical Management Board of ISO in order to lead this project committee, you know. When you start off understanding that it is indeed a privilege to be selected to be a leader, something like that, that in and of itself, I think, sets a tone. Early on in my career, when I was early on doing standards development work, I also had the wonderful blessing of having an extraordinary mentor, a gentleman named Tommy Johansson, who is Swede, who was absolutely fabulous as a convener, and I learned so much from him. So I think it's important for all of us to recognize and to appreciate when we see good mentors and to learn as much as we possibly can from them. And that, you know, is part of my success story, is that I was able to recognize and appreciate that which came before me. You know, the other thing that happened is that we understood that we had to reach out to a lot of different disciplines, and we were very fortunate that we did get that wonderful cross-section of people who were willing to come and work together. You know, and then, you know, once you bring these people together, you as a leader, if you instill in them that confidence, if you convey to them that you trust their talent, then you just kind of, you know, you stand back and let the magic happen. And, you know, you intercede when you have to. So a lot of talent, a lot of extraordinary people came together and put together this document. And I am proud to have been at the helm, but I didn't do this alone.
So now, Denise, we are in a very interesting situation in the world. Audit, either first, second, or third party, must happen. You know, accreditation bodies are working with certification bodies to cope with the demands of using the remote audit method. And I read your book, and I was intrigued by one of the statements in it. It says, it is essential to ensure that this escalation of offsite assessment does not result in a dissolution of the integrity of conformity assessment. Could you expand on that concern?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's very important for people to realize that it's not always possible to do a remote audit. And as I say remote audit, we should actually say use remote auditing practices in order to achieve the audit. But everybody has abbreviated this to remote audit. So that's what we will, that's what we'll say. There are certain activities and there are certain environments, for example, a clean room. If you have an organization that has multiple different processes, some of them happen outside of a clean room, some of them happen inside of a clean room, there is transfer of materials, there is the need to assess how well all of that is controlled. It is very, very difficult to do that in a remote, using remote technology. Now, if you have extraordinarily sophisticated users of web conferencing equipment, then it becomes possible. But there are many other instances where it's not. So what I have been doing personally with my surveillance audits, because I do third-party assessments, is when you have a surveillance, the rules that apply to surveillance is that you are not required to audit the entire system. You select specific processes and you audit those with the understanding that you will audit the other processes during the next cycle of the surveillances. So what I've done with many of my third-party assessment clients is that I've gone and selected those processes that were more amenable to web conferencing technology, to screen sharing, and selected those with the anticipation that in 12 months, dear God, hopefully this will all be over and we can go return to some on-site activities, and I will pick up those activities that I couldn't do on-site. But the other danger with this is that you're going to have some companies who are going to say, well, you know, they did it remotely, and they have this this perception in their minds that it's easier, it's faster, and they're getting the same results, and they don't see a lot of what the auditor is doing. So when you have an audit with remote practices, what happens is that the auditor does a great deal of upfront work. There is a review of documentation ahead of time. Many times there are like 3, 4, 5 hours that are spent that are not immediately visible to the auditee. And so you come on and you start doing your interviews, and that only consumes 3 or 4 hours. So the understanding with some people, the perception that's created, is that this is something that's a lot easier. It's a snap. It only takes 3 or 4 hours. And oh, by the way, why are we paying for a full day? Because it didn't take a full day. So it's important that people understand that we're doing things differently and that some of this stuff is being done offsite and is not immediately visible. And you have to continue to remind the auditee during the audit process that, oh, these are the things that I did before we got on this phone call. These are the things that happened before the web conferencing occurred. These are the samples you sent me, which I have already reviewed, and now I'm going to ask you questions about. So we need to have people fully understand that there's as much rigor, if not more in some cases, in a remote audit than there is in an on-site audit. But unfortunately, the perception out there is that these are easier, they're faster, and, oh, we can cut corners with these. And that's not the case. So we've got to make sure that we stay on top of that and don't allow that perception that these are faster, easier, and we can just pass a lot of things by with remote auditing.
The way that we can avoid affecting the integrity of the conformity assessment, then, will that be to make sure that these three elements that we saw in 1911, which is interview, observation, and review of documents, is actually happening.
We have to ensure that it's happening and that we communicate effectively with the auditee what is happening.
Good.
So we're going to talk a little bit further along. You and I had talked before, and we were going to talk about risks associated with the audits. And when we talk about that, we talk about risk. We'll talk a little bit more about making sure that things are happening the way they're supposed to, and some of the risks that are associated with that might affect the integrity. The other thing is that there are some organizations who simply do not have the technology. I have a client that I'm still trying to set up an audit with. They have a lot of constraints. They cannot have people in their facility. They have a lot of people who have compromised immune systems or who are older. So they've set their rules that no one is to enter the building. And yet their technology is, it works for them. They have an effective quality management system, but it's not sophisticated. And when I was trying to ask them questions about web conferencing and giving them examples like Zoom or GoToMeeting, and the response that I got back from the question that I received was, is that a Facebook thing? And at which point I immediately realized that they have no concept of how to do this. They don't have that sophistication.
I understand.
They do have what they need in order to have a good management system, but they do not have a great deal of sophistication in 21st century technology vis-a-vis web conferencing or any of these other tools that we're using. So it's simply not possible. I was trying to explain to them about, you know, having some of the folks use their smartphone so that I could observe some of the assembly processes, and it's just not registering.
Okay.
So that's the other thing, that it's just not going to happen for some folks.
I understand. And Denise, and I gather how important a risk assessment is to determine the feasibility of the remote audit method. And actually, you have a complete chapter about that in your new book. So what are the most frequent or impactful risks when doing remote audits?
Okay. So there are a lot of risks. And as you mentioned, I enumerate, you know, many of them. But there are three heavy hitters. You know, we can cover those. The first one is technology. You know, the risk is that the technology won't work. And one of the ways of mitigating that risk is to, you know, is to test things out ahead of time and to ask many, many, many questions. There are, for example, I mentioned screen sharing. You may have two people in an organization of 300 who are very agile. They have great agility with screen sharing, and no one else has ever used it before. So you say, oh, we're going to do screen sharing, but then when it comes time for the audit, there's only two people who can do that. There are other people who are not going to have access, or they're not going to understand how to use the technology, or they've got legacy software that is so old that it does not work. It's not compatible with some of these technologies, for example, for screen sharing. Other things that could happen is that they don't have the broadband for it, and it crashes and burns. You're in the middle of the audit and everything just cuts out. And you're lost. Everything's gone. So, you know, the whole thing of whether or not the technology will work, whether or not there is that risk that it's going to crash and burn because, you know, the system just cannot accommodate it, whether or not people have the agility to be able to use it, you know, all of those kinds of things. So there's a great number of questions that you need to ask up front about those kinds, understand what their technology is. What do they use? Is their system cloud-based? So are we going to be trying to interface into web conferencing and then link that up to a cloud-based system? And how is that going to work? And some of that takes me to the second risk, which is security. So you have to worry about security breaches. You have to ensure that you as an auditor do not have a porous firewall, because you incur the liability for protecting the auditee's information that they are communicating with you through through the electronic medium. So you've got to ensure the integrity of your system. You've got to make sure that when you do screen sharing, that it's something that is approved and that is authorized. If you have someone who has, for example, contracts that have a great deal of security around them, or there's regulatory restrictions around them, there's ITAR, something else like that, you've got to ensure that that is managed in such a way so that you do not violate those protocols. If you are downloading records, you incur the liability for those records on your server. You have to make sure that you protect that information and that you purge it. If it's in your email stream, so you say, please send me these files. Now, they're not just on your computer. They're in your email stream. They could be on multiple different devices. If you put it on a flash drive and moved it to another location, you have to protect that information. That onus is upon you. So, and you may find out, that's the other thing, going back to planning and risk, you may find out that you have started the audit with the anticipation that you're going to get all this information, and then someone from the IT department shows up first day of this audit and says, you can't do this. You know, we have prohibitions against that. I don't care what was agreed. This is not allowed. This violates our security.
Yes.
So all of that needs to be taken into consideration, and auditors have to fully understand the risks associated and the liability that they incur when they say, send me your stuff or share your stuff with me. Very, very important. And the other piece to that is, if you're auditing, let's say, and one of the facilities is in the European Union, is they've got the GDPR, which protects personal data. You've got that other piece. So you better be up on that and make sure that you're not violating those rules. So security, huge risk, and it can be managed, but make sure you ask the right questions. The third risk, sampling. Now, if you're on site and you pull a sample and you have a lousy sample, you can always say, hey, can you get me another sample? Or let's go and look over here. Let's pull another random sample of these. Easy, no problem. Remotely, you can't do that. You've asked for them ahead of time. So what's the risk? The risk is that the sample that's provided is not representative of the population. It's not a homogeneous sample. So it's not representative, and it doesn't provide you with the information that you need in order to be able to verify objectively conformance of a process. The other thing is that you don't have enough, because there's too many variables in the samples, and you need, because let us say purchasing is a good example. So they're purchasing stuff, and they're purchasing raw materials, and they're purchasing outsourced processes, and they're purchasing customized components. All of those things have different little spins on them. So having a small sampling of only three or four purchase orders is not going to get you what you need, especially if any one of those samples is inappropriate, because then you have an inadequate sample. You don't have enough. The other thing that you have to worry about, and it's a bit of an outlier, but you will find it in organizations where they already know they're in trouble or they're trying to conceal something. If they're selecting the samples and you have no opportunity to intervene or to somehow direct the selection of the samples, they can cherry pick whatever samples they want and create a picture that is not representative of the process. So there's a lot of things around that. The biggest hedge on that is to understand what samples are going to provide the best evidence, number one, and ask for more than what you need, because you're not going to have that chance to go back Or if you do, it's going to be very awkward and it's going to be time consuming to say, oh, I need more samples. Well, then they've got to get off the call. They've got to go. They've got to run and get those samples and come back. So everybody says, okay, we're going to leave the conference room where we've all set up in front of the mics, and we're going to go back, and we're going to come back in 15 minutes, and then you've got the whole issue with they're reconvening, and everybody's coming in, and you've lost half an hour for no good reason. So those are the three heavy hitters. Whether or not you have the technology that works, whether or not you have sufficiently vetted the security issues, and whether or not you've done a good job of defining your sample requirements.
I love them, Denise. I mean, all our listeners, you see technology, security, sampling. Be aware of those. These are very, very important. And thanks for the explanation, Denise. That's fantastic. There is another part that called my attention in your book that says, assessment of the documents should facilitate adequate understanding of the process to begin building the audit plan. So, should auditors be earnest on a document review before planning the remote audit?
It's kind of like the prep starts to bleed into the actual audit when you have this remote situation. But what I'd like to do is to liken it to compare it to a third-party stage one assessment. So when you have a new company or organization going for certification, they have a stage one audit and stage two audit. And encompassed in the stage one audit is a review of the documents. So you're not really doing a document control audit. You're not looking to see whether or not the documents are well controlled, whether or not there is change control and revision control or the integrity of all the information. But what you're really doing is you're doing a very high-level review to see what the heck do the documents say? Do they define the processes? Well, if you're trying to understand, especially if it's your first time with an organization, what it is that they do, you know, ask for a sample of some documents. Ask for if they have a quality manual, use that. Ask for two or three of their key procedures. Ask for a sample of a manufacturing router. And so that gives you a sense of how they operate, and it will help you to better plan on what kind of samples you're going to be asking for. So it's not really an assessment of the documentation as a requirement itself, but an overview. So perhaps I should have used a better word rather than assess. An overview of the documentation so that you can inform yourself as to how their system operates.
Yeah, so understanding the processes. I mean, have a better understanding of the right. company, especially if you are going for the first time there, right?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and if you're doing a stage one, then, you know, it all happens, you know, in course. But let us say that it is a surveillance audit and you did not do the original certification audit. It was done by another auditor who has since moved on, or for some other reason, you get selected to do the surveillance. You've never been in there before. You know, it's appropriate to ask for something up front because you have no clue of how their processes work.
I understand. And I can imagine that if you go to these type of companies with multiple sites, you need to understand that, I mean, what is happening, right? What processes are inside, on-site, and what processes are perhaps contracted, right?
Exactly. Or you've got a situation where, for example, and I've seen a couple of these, where you've got the main manufacturing facility, and then there's a second smaller facility where they do shipping, and they do just small assemblies, but they're not doing the large manufacturing. So you've got large manufacturing in one thing, then you've got the smaller facility, and they're doing more than just shipping. They're also doing some assembly and some other little, you know, reworks and things like that. So, so you've got to determine how much time you're going to spend on this, and what is the relationship between the two of those, and how well is that managed, and the transfer of materials between those two. So, yeah, all of that, you have to have some overview of how that works, how they operate.
Great, Denise. I mean, something that I like very much of this conversation is that you have been able to present to us a little bit of what is before the audit and during the audit. After the audit, what would you say is something key, critical that we have to take into account when reporting when reporting out of, when we use the remote audit method?
Well, first of all, it's appropriate, and in actuality, the third part of the CBs, the certification bodies, are requiring it. You have to put into the audit report a statement, a paragraph about how the audit was conducted. Now, this is something that for a lot of auditors is new, and they need to be able to determine if the auditor has indeed provided the adequate rigor, brought the adequate rigor to their audit and has performed the audit in accordance with good audit practice. So as part of the audit, this is something that in the past would have been a very brief statement. I did this at this location. Now it's, this is what we did. We used this kind of technology, blah, blah, blah. I've had at least two that I've done where it's been part on-site and part remote. I had one where 75% of it was remote, and then 25% of it was on-site. Well, you described this is what we did for the remote audits, and it was also two different locations. And this is what we did on-site, and adding the details about things like, for example, because of the pandemic, because of this, these were, the social distancing protocols that we had to follow, that kind of stuff. And again, because this is relatively new, it's important to have that text in there. And the other thing that you do is, because this is still relatively new for a lot of folks, is to afterwards, discuss with the audit manager, audit program manager, how did it all play out? Were there constraints? Were there problems? Were there concerns? So that's, the two things. Make sure that you have adequate text in your audit report as to how the audit was conducted, and that there's some kind of formal or informal review afterwards that looks to see exactly how well and how effective the process was. And also, the bottom line, were we able to achieve the audit objective?
That's a key. That's a key statement. And then it's because at the beginning of this conversation, you were saying, are we going to be able to audit everything? And I think it is going to be very important in that report to say, this particular process about, this coding process, it was not possible to audit according, based on the available technology, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And
absolutely.
And Denise, finally, and so you are a library of stories, but finally, I need to ask you, so what do you see any evolution of the auditing activity because of ICT? More than the ICT, the use of more technology, if you do, where are we going?
You know what has happened is that we were remote auditing practices have been around for a while. They've been around for almost two decades in some particular industries. So, but it's always been little pockets, and it's been really a very small subset of the entire audit industry. Two things have happened. Number one, the technology was not there 20 years ago, and it is here now. And number two, the pandemic hit and forced the whole thing upon us. With that pandemic is all of this technology that had started to emerge and started to mature became more available, and people's agility with it, their ability to use it, the affordability of it, all of these things have just exploded in the last 3 or 4 months. So good tools, not just, tools that, will get us by, but good tools have come out, have emerged that are making it possible for us to do some of this stuff remotely and to do it successfully. And that simply wasn't the case years ago. So I think that there is going to be an evolution where there's going to be more of it done remotely. But I think that there's always going to be the need to do some of it on site. And there are certain kinds of audits, like, for example, environmental management. That's really hard to do remotely. It's environmental.
Totally.
You want to stand and look at the environment, or if it's occupational health and safety, that kind of has to be there to see it. So there are always going to be those things that you have to be on site for. And I think that it's also important for people to see the auditors and to interact with them. But there is definitely going to be more of a push. It was coming, but the pandemic it was like a tsunami that just, you know, we rode that thing all the way into shore, and we're here.
Denise, I've been doing audits on certification body for some time, according to 17021 and other standards. And something that I've been witnessing at this moment is that some CBs are considering now mixed audits, right? That they can do, you know, management review, internal audits, corrective action, some of those things remotely, and the other 12 hours or 8 hours on site. So that might be something in the future. Do you think so?
I think so. I think that's a great model. I'm actually hoping for that, because there are some things. I have conducted audits where the first 2 or 3 hours I'm sitting in a conference room by myself reviewing records, because when you're doing management review, internal audits, obviously there's going to be an interview that occurs after that. But in order to be able to have the information to be able to conduct a good interview, you've got to review all of the records of the management review. And to digest all of that, if they've done a really good management review, a credible management review, it can take an hour to go through all of that stuff and then bring in the president of the company and some of the other senior management and interview them about decisions that were made, et cetera, et cetera. So if I could do that offsite, I mean, definitely, I think that model of having some of it happening offsite, some of it onsite, I think it's an excellent model, and I would fully endorse it.
Excellent. And Denise, wow, it's fantastic. You have to give us another time for another interview, another conversation with us.
Sure, anytime, Eric.
Denise, I mean, thank you very much again, my friends in the ISO coach. We are very fortunate to have Denise here, and Denise, thank you again. I mean, it was great to have your point of view here, your experiences and stories.
You are very, very welcome, Eric.
I love it, Denise. Thank you very much. Congratulations on your book, Remote Auditing. And thank you for your voluntary work leading people from all over the world to produce ISO 19011. That was great. My friends, we heard from Denise about very important success factors when doing remote audits. I gathered that there are 3 critical risks to keep in mind. Technology, are we all in? Are we competent? And by we, I mean auditors and auditees. Second, security. Are we conscious of the confidentiality and data protection agreements? That's very important, my friends. We may have liabilities, so be careful. Security is very important. And sampling. Because a great part of the integrity of the conformity assessment will rely on the validity of our sampling. So keep those 3 in mind, those critical risks: technology, security, sampling. Also, before going to an audit, under the remote audit method, make sure that you have a good understanding of the processes. You can ask for key documents, a description of the interaction of their processes, or review of previous reports. But whatever you do, my friend, make sure that you are adding value to the business. Remember that, my friend, consultant and or internal coach in your company, when we design, when we implement management systems in any industry, we wanted to add value. We wanted to support the business. And that's very important. That's something that we should not forget. We should not not only forget, but we should maintain and improve all the time, because that's what we do. My friends, thank you very much. I appreciate that you are having this time with me and the ISO Coach podcast. I'm very happy to have you today. If you like what you heard with Denise and in this podcast, I will appreciate if you leave a review there. And please subscribe to this channel, so every time we have a new podcast, a new episode, you are going to be notified. So subscribe to the ISO Coach podcast, because this podcast is for you. For you, my friend consultant, for you, my friend internal coach. Thank you very much for being here. Take care and be good.